To mask or not to mask, that's now an option in most Vermont schools. It will be a decision that's up to parents, students, and school administrators based on local circumstances. On Monday, March 14th, the Vermont Health Department's updated COVID-19 guidance went into effect. The guidance had previously recommended people, including students, staff, and faculty in schools, should wear face masks in indoor settings. But with case counts dropping, health officials are allowing Vermonters more leeway to determine for themselves whether they want to wear masks when indoors, such as at restaurants, shops, indoor events, and schools. The state is no longer recommending that school districts maintain masking rules as of March 14th. The Arlington School District School Board is one of several school districts across the state that has voted to allow face masks to be optional and adopted the new education agency guidelines, which also makes wearing masks on school buses optional as well. According to a memorandum issued on March 3rd by the state's Agency of Education, all other COVID guidelines for schools have been rescinded, and the same health department guidelines for the general public will now apply to people in schools. Agency of Education Secretary Daniel French discussed this change with us.
We had a policy mechanism around 80% vaccination level in schools, and if you had achieved a student vaccination level of 80%, you didn't have to have masks. And we had deferred that go live. I think we created that in September of last year, and we kept putting it off. You know, then Delta hit, then Omicron, and we were like, no, can't implement this yet. So the first sort of turn of the spigot, so to speak, to borrow a phrase from last year, was to enable that 80% thing to happen. And we announced that in advance of school vacation, because most of our schools were out that third week of February. As we were on this sort of glide slope, we wanted it to be a smooth glide slope, not a bumpy one. So we wanted to message to superintendents, look, when you come back from vacation, the 28th is going to be the first turn of the spigot where we're going to allow that 80% thing to go live. And then when we came back from vacation, it had shifted 180 degrees. People are like, when can we take off our mask? Because I think, as we predicted, when people took a week off or were able to travel a little bit or get out, they could see that, you know, society was in the middle of this transition, right? So schools were now suddenly behind the time, so to speak. But we've always, you know, adopted specific recommendations for schools because we had a large number of students that weren't vaccinated and so forth. So it was warranted. But that was the first approach, was, you know, February 28th to kind of do that 80%. But as conditions have continued to stay on that trajectory, we ultimately, you know, shortly thereafter, when people got back from vacation, we made that a next announcement, which ultimately was this Monday, March 14th, that masks are optional. So, you know, our other goal there was to not, you know, need specific mitigation recommendations for schools. So we wanted to have schools live under the broader recommendations for all Vermonters. We weren't comfortable on the 28th shifting the whole state yet to that sort of lesser level of mitigation recommendation. So we looked at March 14th as sort of being the perfect moment to do both to pivot schools to the broader mitigation requirements and to change those broader mitigation requirements relative to the Omicron variant being behind us. So that's kind of how it all came together. Seems to be going pretty well this week. It means firstly that school districts have the option to require masks if they want to, you know, and we've, absent a state emergency in this whole school year, we have not had a state of emergency. So we've leveraged local authority and responsibility of school boards to protect their schools, to enact our mitigation recommendations. As you know, in the fall, when we recommended masks, we had virtually every school in the state adopt that, except for one. But every other school board, it was still optional, essentially, since the beginning of the year, but every school board except for one adopted our recommendation to mandate masks. Similarly, you know, it's optional. You know, school districts don't have to follow our recommendations to not require masks, but some chose to do, and some chose to remove masks earlier than the March 14th deadline as well. So that's the first level, is just to reinforce the fact that there is a element of local decision-making. But if it's enacted according to our recommendations, then yes, inside the school building, we kind of shift this idea of personal responsibility and personal risk assessment. So there are individuals that feel that they need to wear masks, and that should be fine. And, you know, we need to get to that place inside of schools, which I'm hearing that students and staff are doing that very easily. You know, they understand that sort of mutual respect compact of the schoolhouse. And that's working out pretty well. And what from I'm seeing across the broader society, I think it's going well also. So it is optional. Everyone has different risk levels, but I think it's also fair to say we're in a moment of transition again, you know? So some of the anxiety around that isn't really about risk, it's perception of risk, and people need to feel comfortable making those changes.
If there was to be another variant that was like that, I mean, is there a threshold where we'd say, well, we have to go back to wearing face masks and making that mandatory?
Yeah, I think, it's we don't talk about specific thresholds. Honestly, as a state, we never bought into that approach. We've always been more inclined to monitor trends, if you will. And, it's a set of multiple factors. And, there's always going to be variants of the virus. And the two that you mentioned, or one that you mentioned, is these are sort of sub-variants, if you will, of Omicron. We'll always have this sort of cyclical nature of the virus. Maybe it'll be close to seasonal flu. We don't know, but that's some of the thinking that's out there. And that's, I think, the easiest metaphor we have right now to understand it. But, we follow the trends on this, and the bottom line, which has been a less of a cyclical trend, but a sort of a continuous trend, is that the risk from the virus continues to go down. So as much as we can think about the cyclical nature of cases, for example, which is how we monitored, certainly the first year of the virus, the risk continues to decrease as a result of several variables, one being vaccination, of course. And broader strategy isn't so much focused on masks, but that's, I'd say, politically the more glamorous representation of the change. And I spend certainly quite a bit of time with superintendents. I also spend time with school nurses and the leadership of the School Nurses Association. Their views have been really important for me to understand, what's going on. They spend a lot of time with staff in their offices, understanding their anxiety levels and so forth. So I think it's fair to say we're in a transition this week. Today's the 16th. We went live with our recommendation to remove masks on the 14th. We have two student members on the State Board of Education. We had a State Board of Education meeting this morning, and unsolicited, both of them reported what a sense of relief it was not to have a mask requirement. One of the student members is still feels anxious that she wants to wear a mask, but she too remarked it's like a weight off our shoulders, so to speak, like they're getting closer to normal. The next sort of, we talk about masks, but the other mitigation aspect that's still in transition for schools, that's still unique to schools, is our testing platform. So we have what we call Test at Home, and we also have a staff assurance testing program. So those testing programs will be phased out over time. We didn't want to do all of this at once, so we wanted the testing to still be in place while we made the transition away from masking. But we are in a process of transitioning the larger state testing platform, and the school transition will sort of mirror that approach. So at the state level, we're moving away from sort of the PCR-based state-run testing centers that we've all come to know. Coming up in April, those sites will become more distribution sites of antigen tests as opposed to PCR. We'll still do PCR. It's a very important technology. But those state sites will become more distribution centers for antigen tests. So probably sometime in April, we will shut down. When that shift happens at the state level, we'll shut down the specific testing program inside of schools and tell school people they can go to these other sites to get access to the tests. And then probably by May, we'll be shutting down those state sites altogether. Because in between now and May, the supply will be building considerably from the federal investment in antigen testing, so we'll have more access to that. So those state testing sites will be shut down in favor of folks just accessing testing through pharmacies, or the tests will be everywhere, essentially, and very affordable. So,
we also spoke with Dr. Randy Lowe, the superintendent of the Bennington-Rutland Supervisor Union, on what their policy will be for their schools, which include elementary and middle schools in Sunderland, Manchester, Dorset, Danby, and the Floodbrook School, which serves the mountain towns of Londonderry, Peru, and Landgrove. The supervisor union also takes in the Metairie School District, which serves Rupert and Paulet, along with the Windhall School District.
So, this whole pandemic, we've had all kinds of experiences and perspectives, and that I don't think is entirely different now. I would say that the majority of people, just given the trajectory of how we've been moving, have been anticipating that this day would come, and most were very ready for it. we definitely had some families and continue to have families who are concerned, right? They're not sure. And so if you go into our schools today, you see students and adults wearing masks, and you see students and adults not wearing masks. And I have been messaging as frequently as I can to folks that I want that to be the culture of our schools. I want it to be very normalized that anybody may be in a mask for any reason at any time, for a short period of time, for a long period of time, because we all have our own personal situations we're navigating. And that, you know, we are all at any given point assessing our own personal risk level, the risk level of our children. We do that in every single aspect of our life at any rate, regardless. Am I going to go out? It's snowing out. Do I feel comfortable driving to Bennington or, you know, to wherever I need to go? I'm assessing my personal risk. It's the same thing, I think, right now with how comfortable people are wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. And I want that to be enculturated in our schools.
With only a couple of months left in the school year, school officials are hoping that case counts stay low and no new variants of COVID emerge to complicate things. And all have stressed that individual decisions around whether or not to wear face masks should be respected. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On Friday, March 18th, at the Arlington Common, an entrepreneur challenge was held to pick a winner for a $25,000 prize to local businesses from Bennington County who, in the opinion of a three-judge panel, came up with the best or most interesting idea designed to grow the business's revenue. The challenge was hosted by Lever Incorporated, a North Adams, Massachusetts-based economic development nonprofit agency founded in 2014 that focuses on innovation-driven job creation. The entrepreneur challenges are designed for employees within established companies who are innovating from within, using entrepreneurial methods and ideas that create new revenue. The Bennington Entrepreneur Challenge was open to any Bennington County company with over $500,000 in annual revenue, and the proposed innovations had to be aimed at growing the revenue, not reducing costs. Jeff Thomas, the executive director of Lever, told us more.
So we ran our first challenge in Berkshire County in 2019 for intrapreneurs, and we've run several since. This is our first entrepreneur challenge in Bennington County. Very excited about it.
So what gave you the idea to bring it up here from the Berkshires?
Well, we've actually worked with a number of entrepreneurs in Bennington County for some time, and we are aware that there's a great resources here for entrepreneurs. We learned in Berkshire County, though, that mature companies that seek to innovate have a little harder time finding help. And so we were excited about the opportunity to help companies grow here and help companies create jobs.
So an intrapreneur then is someone who's already been in business for a while and is trying to branch out or come up with a new product of some sort. That's basically the difference between an intra and an entrepreneur.
That's right. The intrapreneur has a job. Many entrepreneurs are self-funded and starting with very few resources, whereas intrapreneurs are building innovations within a pre-existing system, and in fact have a lot of advantages. We see, though, for mature companies, often I like to say the urgent trumps the important. It's important to be continuously innovating, and yet the day-to-day sometimes makes that hard. So that's, I think, one of the best reasons for companies to be part of our program, is that we give them a structure to innovate from and help them carve out the time they need to stay competitive.
The five finalists who made it to the deciding round of the competition were Authentic Designs of West Rupert, Vermont, Starwind Turbines of East Dorset, Grateful Dog of Manchester, Old Mill Road Media of East Arlington, and MSK Engineers of Bennington. Each gave a 10-minute presentation of their ideas and then answered questions from the judges. We had a chance to talk to a couple of the entrepreneurs during a break in the program. Jason Dolmich, the president of MSK Engineers, said their plan involved finding ways to remove lead from water pipe service lines and remediation of municipal water systems.
either BCRC or Lever themselves reached out and asked whether we'd be interested, and I said yes. I actually said, I'm a civil engineer. What kind of entrepreneurial thing do I have to offer?
So your presentation was about getting lead out of service lines.
That's
a big problem, apparently.
It is. The EPA estimates between 9 and 12 million across.
What would you do then with the, if you win, what would you do with the money? How would you invest that?
To start with, I'd say we use this as an opportunity to really hone our strategy and think about how we might deploy it in other communities. So, I've already received the benefit. but we really intend to focus it on all of the marketing and recruitment efforts that we plan to employ over the next 6 months.
Authentic Designs from West Rupert advanced an idea to bring top-tier design to solar or other alternative energy-powered outdoor lights. Michael Krause, the president of Authentic Designs, discussed their project.
It has been for us a really, really useful kind of panoramic look at what we've been doing for a long time. And of course, you can become entrenched in things. So this really helped us to sort of dissect and evaluate what works for us and how we may be able to push this idea of renewable energy powering lights that I've had for years and always put on a back burner into a more forward place. So regardless of the outcome, we have won.
What are the main challenges to getting a product like that, which on the surface seems like a pretty obvious common sense idea?
Yes.
Scaling that up?
I would say, in terms of scaling it up, it's finding, to some degree, some of our operations can be done by people, and I've trained many of them in our shop to do the activities. What will be more of a challenge for us, I think, is how to understand and manipulate the energy sources. You know, lithium-ion batteries have issues with cold weather. So finding solutions to that, we are frankly going to, as my son indicated, engineers smarter and more experienced than us to help us with unraveling those knots, if you will.
In the end, MSK came in first place, with Authentic Designs as the runner-up. Lever has been hosting these entrepreneur challenges for the past several years in Berkshire County, and this year was its first one involving firms from Bennington County. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Saturday, March 19th, was Maple Open House Day at Merck Forest in Rupert. For the first time since the COVID emergency struck 2 years ago, Merck Forest was able to host its annual celebration of one of Vermont's most iconic industries, maple syrup. And people were ready. The parking lot remained full for the entire day. It takes about 40 gallons of sap to make a gallon of maple syrup, and Merck's facilities manager and head sugar maker, Dylan Durkee, walked us through how it got made at Merck Forest.
Enough to have a really efficient operation. We got 33 acres that run. You can actually look out and see it. We got these black lines that come down into an old farm milk tank, and it's about 4,000 gallons that can hold the sap. And then once we get all that collecting inside of that sap tank, it runs down into these white pipes into the reverse osmosis machine. Now, our reverse osmosis machine is not as updated as others, but we can concentrate ours to 8%, which takes out 3/4 of the water. So it really saves a lot of wood, a lot of time, because we could boil all day, all night, and then maybe be done. But this here, we can boil in about 4 to 5 hours in a good boil. Once it goes from that reverse osmosis machine, we look at, it comes right into that back tank. The back tank pushes the concentrate, is what we call it, not sap because it's concentrated more into closer to syrup. Goes up into our top tank up there, and then it gravity feeds down into the system. It runs into this flue pan, is what we call it. So this is separated. This is the steam away, and this is the flue pan. The flue pan then takes a lot more of that moisture out from there. We're looking, I think we're talking like 20-22% by the time we it goes from this flue pan, which it runs through a series of pipes. So depending on which way we route the sap to come. And then it goes into this front pan. The front pan is where we're making the syrup.
The sap house was full of visitors, and one of them was Danielle Morris from New Haven, Vermont, who's this year's reigning Miss Vermont.
So I actually have a busy schedule for this weekend and next weekend, and I get to travel around to all different sugar shacks that had me come here, so I'm hopefully going to have lots of shots of maple syrup and meet a lot of Vermonters, so it'll be a fun weekend.
Merck's homegrown sap comes from almost 3,000 taps on their own sugar bush, and they've been making syrup there for more than 60 years. Chris Hubbard, their education director, told us more.
Sure. So our Maple Open House, we have activities for kids, scavenger hunts, we have some storytelling, we have tapping demonstrations, we have baby animals, we have baby pigs and lambs. We have a backyard boiling demonstration going on, some displays that describe the process of maple sugaring and our production in particular, as well as food. Our main sugar bush is actually this hillside behind here. So that's where the bulk of our syrup is coming in from. So there should be tours of that with the production line going. We also have, you know, some activities for kids there as well, that kids can pick up scavenger hunts, as I said, you know, exploring how many, you know, say quarts of sap it would take to make one quart of sap.
Liz Ruffa, the Director of Institutional Advancement, gave us some more background.
This is the first time since March 2019 that Merck has been able to have a public event like this. Because we, when COVID blanketed the region in March 2 years ago, we were just organizing this at when we used to do a pancake breakfast. And so we realized that that wasn't something that we could do in terms of public safety. And we have been certainly open to the public, which has been a real refuge for a lot of people that live here during COVID, for people to be able to come and spend time outside and get some fresh air and some exercise. But we have really had to curtail our public programming. We put a lot of it online, and we continue to work with the schools, mainly going more to their campuses to work with them as we could. But this is kind of like our reawakening. So it's a perfect spring day. It's not raining. There are tons of people here again. The parking lot is full. And Merck Forest is just thrilled to kind of be back in the mix.
Merck Forest offers hiking trails and other outdoor recreational opportunities, but today was all about the sweet stuff. As usual, weather in Vermont in late winter to early spring is iffy and unpredictable, but so far the sap seems to be running pretty good, at least up on the mountain. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.